Hello and welcome to day three of the EuroCopa podcast sponsored by Sling Latino. I'm your host, Nipun Chopra. Thank you for joining us today. Before we get started, I'd like to get you guys involved in the conversation. So please tweet at us at WSoccerTalk or use the hashtag EuroCopaPod to give us your feedback. Tonight, we'll be previewing Group D in Copa, as well as taking a position-by-position look at the U.S. men's national team. Joining me to do that on tonight's journey are massive Tim Sherwood fan Karthik Krishnayer, huge Brendan Rodgers fan Gabe Smith, and Nipun Chopra super fan Kristen Henaj. Thanks, guys, for joining us. So, Group D preview, guys. Let's do this. Argentina, first of all, probably winners of this whole thing, right? I think we will probably all be in agreement that they are far favorites for this. Karthik, that's probably because they have a few unheard of players, much like Peru. People like Otamendi, Rojo, Banega, Mascherano, Pastore, Aguero, Higuain, Lamela, Di Maria, Nicolas Gaitan, Lavezzi, and an up-and-coming star that no one's really heard about, Leo Messi. So based on those players, probably group and overall favorites.
They are overall favorites for this tournament, Nipun, but of course, they were favorites in 2015, lost to Chile in the final, quite in a heartbreaking sense, and they were playing the host country. They were the favorites entering 2011. They didn't win it. They bombed out in the knockout, early knockout stages. 2007, they were the overwhelming favorites. Dunga right. took what was thought of as an experimental squad to the Copa. Guess what? Brazil beat them 3-0 in the final. So there's a heavy burden on this Argentina team, and there are already people saying, well, this isn't really a real Copa. Well, trust me, at this point, Argentina will take anything, and they are the favorites for this tournament. On paper, we don't see how any other side could beat them, but as I said, the last three Copas, they've been the favorite, and they've not come out on top. So that's worth considering.
Yeah, Chris, one of the things that's going on right now is that there's a lot of off-the-field stuff. And by that, I mean there have been issues at the Football Federation. There was a certain amount of talk that Argentina might pull out of the Euros, of Copa. That has now been put to bed. Both Karthik sent me an article, as well as Sam Kelly, who's in Buenos Aires, confirmed that they are not pulling out of Copa. So that has been sorted, but this is not the sort of mindset you want Argentina to go into this Copa with?
No, of course not. I think, you know, it's a curious thing in that regard, because in 95, the US famously almost pulled out, or the players threatened to pull out because they couldn't agree their bonus structure with the USSF. And in some regards, that actually bonded the players together in a way that I think helped propel them to some degree to a fourth place finish, which is still their best ever finish. I'm not sure if that same mentality will transfer with this Argentina team. And equally, my concern with them, and I think some of this is due to the fact that attacking line and that midfield line is so impressive. You listed the names yourself there, Nipun. It's contrasting it with the defense, though. That's where my issues are with this team. There's a few in there who don't have a lot of international experience. Jonathan Maidana being one, Ramiro Funes Mori, Victor Quiseta, all under 10 caps. Gabriel Mercado was another one, the River Plate defender, under 10 caps. Now, of course, I appreciate what some people will say, that the likes of Funes Mori, etc., they're good players. They've shown they're good players. Of course they are. You won't hear me try and argue otherwise here. What I will say is international football is a different beast.
Yeah.
And I've heard enough ex-pros, and I've spoken to enough who've said as much, that there are subtle nuances to playing at international level. And my concern for Argentina would be that that defence may let them down, that there's not, when you look at that back line, there's not a guiding light there. There's not someone to just calm things down. I mean, we've seen Otamendi is quite cavalier and at times rash in his approach, or at least he has been with City. And that's my issue, is there's no one just calming things down at the back for them. And it could be their undoing in this tournament for me.
Gabe, I actually agree entirely with Chris here. Actually, I'm getting tired of people agreeing with Chris. I listened to the last two episodes, and all of us are agreeing with Chris. So let's start disagreeing with him a little bit, but not right now, because what he said is on the money. The Argentina, if there's one issue with Argentina, it is the defense. Because as he mentioned, Otamendi has had a patchy season. Marcos Rojo has had a patchy season. Funes Mori, anyone that's ever listened to World Football Phone-In knows the thoughts that they have about Funes Mori, and in the sense that he can be very unreliable. He's had a decent season with Everton, but he's always guilty of, you know, some errors in every single game. And then in some ways, their best defender is Mascherano, who is not really a defender. So from that perspective, I guess we have to look at that defense, don't we? And say that even the likes of Chile in their group can be looking at that defense and find ways to get past it.
Yeah, no, I definitely think that's the case. And you want to, you know, also add in then the goalkeeper, you know, Sergio Romero, right, with Manchester United, who played very sparingly through the course of the season, you know, after the whole entire De Gea transfer debacle went down.
Hasn't really played since August of 2015.
So, you know, you can't really say that you have then a lot of confidence with him between the sticks as well. So, you know, kind of grouping in there, I think there is certainly some question marks in the defense. You know, specific players that you mentioned there, I think Funes Mori has probably had the, you know, the better season of the three between Otamendi and Marcus Rojo. You know, Rojo is a player who's been, you know, experimented then in that left back position that I just don't think is his ideal position. You've had Argentina in the past that have played,
right,
some different formations to where they played in a three center back, formation at the back. And I think that probably is Rojo's best position if Argentina do decide to do that, although I don't think that they will, just because they really don't have enough depth, I think, at center back to really be able to pull that off throughout the entire tournament. Maybe in a game, a one-off situation where the formation itself then makes sense. And I think really that you know, as much as there's question marks on the defense, I think overall you have to say that Argentina's challenge is always finding the right balance in the squad, mm-hmm, lineup. I mean, they just have so many options in the midfield and attack that I think, you know, it can become an attacker's wet dream there and the type of options they have. But to make sure that you have then some balance there in midfield, which is mainly going to be Mascherano for sure in that holding role, trying to protect in the back four. But I do like this Argentina squad. I think Ever Banega, who will be another option that will be good in terms of ensuring to connect the attack and getting to the options of you know, Aguero, Di Maria, and obviously we know about Lionel Messi, but I think just to kind of close out, I really expect an impressive performance from Higuain through this tournament. I think we're kind of talking about Argentina exercising demons as a whole, as a squad, from the past. Higuain specifically is one of those players you can put in that category with some missed penalties then in the past that has had Argentina suffer. I actually put him down right now as my likely candidate for the Golden Boot then at the end of this tournament.
I think we have to remember as well is Gerardo Martino has a lot of pressure on him at this point because his career in Europe, I think, is quite defined by the fact that he was seen as a failure at Barcelona, that he let Atletico win the league. He's still highly thought of in South America, granted, but this would be the World Cup, Copa America. He's lost on big stages, a lot of pressure. And granted, again, there will be some members of this squad that weren't present during those games, so come in with a fresh mentality. Mm-hmm. There are also those who were present. And if I'm him at this precise moment, going into this tournament, knowing we're favourites, in some ways it's one of those I can't win situations, because if he does do it, everyone will say, well, we expected this, we all predicted this. If they don't, it will be seen as the third failure in his tenure with the national team.
Kartik, let's talk about Chile now. Current defenders of the title, as you mentioned early on, beat Argentina last year in the final. There's some good things in the squads and some things that have changed since. Obviously, Sampaoli has left the left the country. The national team. That's one change. But the personnel-wise, there's a lot of continuity in terms of Matias Fernandes, Alexis Sanchez, Vargas Castillo, Gary Medel is still in defense. So I guess that's a positive. And of course, they're one of the best midfielders in the world, Arturo Vidal. So talk to me about Chile.
Yeah, this is they still play a style that was put in place by Bielsa, continued by Sampaoli, two Argentine managers. Now Pizzi is managing them. They've got still a fantastic squad of players, maybe not compared to Argentina, who, of course, they beat in the final last year, but compared to most squads in this Copa America tournament. You're still looking at players like Arturo Vidal, Alexis Sanchez, top class players. Gary Medel is at the international level, for me, one of the better defenders in South America. He may not replicate that necessarily with his club form in Italy in the year or two he was in England, but at the international level, he's fantastic. There's certain players that are better at the international level than they are at the club level. Mm-hmm. We'll get into this when we get into previewing the Euros, because there's a lot of guys on that continent that fit that bill. But Medel is in that category. This ultimately is a difficult ask for them, coming a year, 12 months, 11 months after they won at home in a Copa America that even though it's a centenario, it is a kind of a ceremonial tournament. It's not... it includes CONCACAF countries, and there was so much that was asked of them to win that at home, and then the turmoil after with Sampoli leaving, Pizzi coming in as the manager. But I still expect them to be very, very strong in this group and have them second.
Yeah. Chris, anything to add to that? Do you see them finishing second? I think we all probably do. They probably have the beating of Panama and Bolivia pretty comfortably.
I think that's a fair point. The issue I have with Chile is a very similar one to Argentina in that sense. It's that defence. It's the fact that, for all the fact that Gary Medel is listed as a defender, I still am not sure personally if he is. And it's for me, it's not even a height thing either. I think, yes, his height is a disadvantage. I find his recklessness a little bit of a concern as well. And it is, at times with Chile, and it was under Sampaoli as well, quite a patchwork defence. And certainly there was a beauty in that, because it fit the sort of narrative of them being this cavalier band of cowboys that just used to tear up the field as if, you know, there was nothing to worry about. But again, I feel as if they're going to be undone, it's going to come through that defensive weakness, just because there's not a huge amount of quality in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the opening game is against Argentina, so that matters. Gabe, let's talk about Panama. Most of this, I had a similar problem that I did with a couple of teams yesterday, including Haiti. I didn't recognize most of the names in this lineup. And one of the names that I did recognize that was on the original lineup, Ismael Diaz, the 19-year-old Porto striker, is injured. So it really is going to come down to Gabriel Gomez, the hardworking defensive midfielder, to try to get anything out of the games against the other teams in this group.
Yeah, I think that's 100% correct. I mean, I had the exact same scenario as you did. Really, the only player that was notable that I've seen and heard some about is Ismael Diaz, then, who's in the essentially the U squad for Porto. But with him being out, I think this is just, you know, it comes back to it. I think it was going to be that case with Diaz in the lineup or not. This is just a team that struggles for some goals at this point. And I think looking at this group, that's going to be the toughest thing to get over. And at least the past couple of friendlies, and World Cup qualifiers that they've had, they've only had one goal in the past three games, and that was against Haiti, who has not necessarily been a juggernaut in the international stage thus far. So it's pretty telling exactly where Panama is. I think this is another team that we can put down then as kind of a team through transition right now. It will be an opportunity, obviously, as it always is in these cases, to where you know, some of the more experienced players have moved on to where it's a great opportunity for some of the youngsters to come through. Like we said, we were with Diaz, a 19-year-old, hoping for that to be his opportunity, but it's just going to have to take then some other players to step up in a, you know, a group that you can at least see them be competitive with Bolivia. I think just in the dynamics then of this group, with definitely the two favorites being Argentina and Chile.
Karthik, are Gabe and I doing disservice to Panama by essentially suggesting that they're making up the numbers in this group?
Yeah, I think to a certain extent, because I think Panama has proven in these one-month events, time and again, going back to 2005 when they went all the way to the Gold Cup final, they were very strong in Gold Cup 2009, lost in a controversial game to Mexico in a knockout stage game to Mexico in Houston, where Javier Aguirre, among others, was sent off, and then made it to the final in 2013. 2015, I thought they were, 2015, they were robbed in the semifinal. So and I'm talking about Gold Cups, but four of the last five Gold Cups, and in 2011, they made it to the semifinals. They actually beat the United States in the group stage, a match I was at in Tampa. So five of the last six Gold Cups, Panama has been very good, has been better than Costa Rica for the most part, better than Honduras, better than Jamaica. Well, Jamaica made the finals last time, but generally better than Jamaica. These countries that have actually qualified for World Cups out of CONCACAF. So in a one-month event held on U.S. soil, Panama is very dangerous. They have a lot of players who either play in Major League Soccer now or have played in Major League Soccer in the past. So that is an added advantage in that they have some familiarity with the terrain. I think we might be selling Panama a little bit short, although it is a tough group. Argentina, they don't face Argentina and Chile in the Gold Cup. They face, you know, countries like the countries they face in CONCACAF. But I think I think they'll finish third in this group. And if someone slips up, they could finish second.
Contrasting that with Bolivia, Chris, what Karthik said about a lot of those players playing in MLS, the Bolivian team comprises almost entirely of players playing in Bolivia. And even though their team's named, like, quote, the strongest, it's not really a strong league. So talk to me about this Bolivian team. They were very poor against the U.S. men's national team on Saturday, especially defensively. At multiple times, the multiple players in the team could have just walked through on goal. And I don't mean that in any figurative way. I mean that literally. And so, yeah, let's start with that. Talk to me about this Bolivian team.
It's an interesting one with Bolivia because my memories of them are 94 and Marco Echeverri and Jaime Moreno, and Echeverri being this wonderful talent. And I've spoken to Bruce Arena, fortunately enough, about him, and he will really eulogize about Echeverri. Their record in this competition isn't great. I mean, they've won it twice, but both times it was on home soil, so you have to think there was a momentum there. The coach is quite a curious chap, Julio Cesar Valdivieso. He once played his 12-year-old son while being a club manager in 2009. He handed a debut to him. I'm reliably informed it did not go well. But as you said,
he gets slide tackled. What happened?
He was a 12-year-old playing with men. What do you think? didn't think I needed to finish the story on that one.
I only asked the most important follow-up questions, Chris.
I think, as you touched on there yourself, though, it's a squad that is sort of struggling to break away from the fact that so many of their players are playing domestic football. I believe you've got Yasmini Duk in the States there with the Cosmos, Bruno Miranda in Universidad de Chile. The one for me who I feel like is a little bit of a miss is Marcelo Moreno, who was at Wigan many years ago and Shakhtar and was sort of, you know, the prominent Bolivian, I think, playing in a major league for a good while there. Having that kind of quality can help a little bit in terms of just bridging that gap. But it's so difficult to look past them being whipping boys. And by no means is this a dig to the United States. That game for me highlighted a lot of the frailties of Bolivia. And if the United States can exploit them with such ease,
right,
I can only imagine what the more elite nations, if you will, can do to that.
Gabe, who do you see finishing third between Panama and Bolivia?
I think just with a little bit you know, more experience at the international stage from some of the players, I do think it's going to be Panama. It's going to finish third in the group. But I am just to see a bunch of goals. I have to say I'm quite looking forward to Bolivia versus Argentina in the group stages. Should be horrible for the Bolivian keeper. That's for sure.
It's interesting. That's the thing I think it's interesting to note is that the coach has actually left off Moreno. And he's also left off a young chap called Sebastian Gamara, who's with Milan's youth team. So you've got to think the players that he's called up, like Juan Carlos Arce, etc., you've got to think they must be better in his head.
He sees something in them, right.
Because they're playing, for the most part, I mean, Juan Carlos Arce, for example, is playing for Bolivar in the home country. Again, standards such as comparing China to Bolivia, you could say it's much of a muchness. I have to think that he's seen something though in those players to think that it was a better idea.
Right. So let's, Karthik, let's start talking about the U.S. men's national team. We're going to talk about each position except goalkeeper, because I think we discussed that on Monday's podcast where we discussed Guzan and Howard in detail. So let's talk about the defenders. This is an area that you highlighted on in the first episode of the Eurocopa podcast brought to you by Sling Latino. Talk to me about this defender position. Who do you like? who do you see might struggle in this tournament?
Well, first off, Dipun, your hosting skills are off the charts. Working in that sponsor mentioned there, so that's
been
great.
I've been working out.
well done. On the back line, I think you could argue the U.S. has the strongest back line that the country has had since the 2002 World Cup. There's some argument made. There was some back and forth on Twitter when I threw this out there earlier today about 2010, because you had Gooch, you had Jay DeMeritt start, Gooch and Jay DeMeritt starting as your center backs. And then you had, obviously, Cherundolo, who's off the charts, maybe the best U.S. suspender of all time up there with Eddie Pope as right back, and left back was Carlos Bocanegra. However, I would point out Bocanegra, by that time was kind of out of position at left back, was slipping, at the club level. I think he was at Rangers at that point, or he might have gone to France. DeMeritt was playing in the championship for Watford. Gooch was on Milan's books, but it played once or twice that previous season. Cherundolo was Cherundolo. He was amazing. Let's compare this back line that we've got right now. We have got potentially, and sorry, I shouldn't say we, the United States. Obviously, I'm American, so I'm saying we. Apologies. Apologies for trying to be neutral, but of course, Gabe and I are, and Nipun, we're all Yanks.
Not quite. I'm still Indian, but I count. Yeah.
And so anyway, the back four, the projected starting back four would have DeAndre Yedlin potentially at right back, someone that Chris saw a lot of this season at Sunderland. He started that entire run in as they escaped relegation, something we've talked about a lot on this podcast in the past. You would have at center back potentially John Brooks, who had a fantastic season for Hertha Berlin, and Jeff Cameron, who had a very good season playing in multiple roles for Stoke. At left back, you could have Fabian Johnson, who was one of the best players for Borussia Mönchengladbach, a team that qualified for that was in the Champions League this past year, qualified for the Champions League again for next season. Although, of course, he plays in the midfield for Mönchengladbach, he will probably play left back. So think about this. That could be the starting four for the U.S. All guys playing at a high level at big European clubs. And you have a guy like Matt Beisler, who's versatile, who's a great ball-playing central defender. We saw him play left back against Bolivia, potentially to slide into one of those roles if one of those guys doesn't work out. I think this is a very good back line, which, again, speaks to there's a lot of spinning going on from the U.S. manager all the time. He's a PR maestro, right, in lowering expectations, passing the buck, throwing other people under the bus, blaming other people. You look at this back line, if the United States doesn't get far in this tournament, you have to think either there's been a serious injury, an officiating mistake, or mismanagement.
So, Chris, one of the things I was struck by yesterday was, or 2 days ago, was the talk about Omar Gonzalez winning Liga MX with Pachuca. And I remember him playing, having an important part to play in the World Cup. And I wonder what's happened with his career with the U.S. men's national team.
I think that's a fantastic question. It's one that I'm not even sure I can answer personally, because again, he has just been crowned a champion. And yet he's not deemed good enough. I thought it was quite interesting to see Jürgen actually congratulate him through Twitter.
Awkward.
Yeah. I noticed a lot of my colleagues in the States picking up on that and commending him for his brass tacks, as we say. I think the curious thing with US centre-backs in general is I don't know how well they mesh together at this precise moment. Maybe I'm a bit of a traditionalist. I quite like the notion of someone who engages and someone who sweeps up. And the best example I can give of that is 2006, Alessandro Nesta, Fabio Cannavaro.
Right.
You would have someone who was a bit quicker and could cover in behind, and someone who was happy to engage and felt comfortable stopping a take-on. I don't know if the US has that kind of physical defender who can cover up the ground exceptionally. I think John Brooks is certainly in that mold. I've just yet to see him truly tested by exceptional pace. And I think, look, that's one of the things you can say about this Copa America tournament and why it's great that the US are in there. This will be a huge test for them, because, yes, they've got the Gold Cup. That is one thing. They've got Hex qualifying, all this stuff. That's wonderful. Copa America is a different beast because you face different teams. There's a different culture to it. And it's funny because I spoke to David James once about this when he was playing a youth tournament for England. And he said, when you
what was
come
that,
up,
like 50 years ago? Wow.
It's 1991, I think. It was the Toulon tournament, funny enough. It's just been occurring in Europe here now. Mm. And he said that, you know, we played Mexico. I think they played Guinea or Senegal. And he said that in playing those different nations, you gained a different culture from it. You understood a different way to play. Now, granted, the players involved here are of a different age. They're fully established professionals. I never think you stop learning, though. Or I never, yeah, I think you never stop learning. That's what I said or meant to say,
yeah,
right?
Sure, sure.
And that will be good for these players.
Yeah. Gabe, you know who will be watching Omar Gonzalez? Our fellow Indy 11 supporters, because we play them. We play Pachuca in a friendly tomorrow.
That is so, that is the case. That is the case, yep. Which I'm going to be missing for this podcast. So I mean, that's tough. But that's no, go proceed. Exactly. We love you.
So
people
Gabe, let's talk about midfield now. You and I got a question on Twitter about this. We were asked about Michael Bradley, who we all adore, and what we were asked what was his best position, and from my perspective, it's more of a Michael Carrick-esque position, a deep lying playmaker. And we saw him do that with ease in the Bolivia game, where he played a two or three balls over the defense that led to goals. In fact, he did that in the World Cup as well, in the last minute in the Belgium game to help score. So that's my opinion on that. What about you? What do you see as the best role for probably the most important piece of this U.S. Men's national team in its entirety?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think he's going to be, you know, the biggest influencer in midfield for the U.S. It would be I think this is kind of where it's tough as a U.S. fan, because, you know, we really don't see a consistent lineup from Jurgen Klinsmann, you know, whether it's friendlies or in tournaments, to really get a good reading as to how this team's going to shape up. You know, I can see us shaping up in a 4-4-2, a 4-3-3. I kind of like when you do have Bradley, though, in kind of a triangle in midfield. You know, having him as the deepest lying playmaker, and at least one person who can kind of play more of that destroyer role, can help break up play. Something then that obviously Jermaine Jones can do well at. And then another presence there in midfield, I think, gets the most balance for this USA squad. And I think that's probably what we're going to see most often in that case. And when Bradley is playing as that kind of deep playmaker role, the whole entire field then is at his disposal. I think his obviously his long-range ability, I would say, is his strongest attribute. And as much time as we can get him on the ball, I think is going to be ideal. My probably biggest concern with just this more, you know, in the central midfield, area, is when we are going to be playing then against teams that are a little bit more mobile, in the midfield. You know, players that are able to come and really drive, and attack a player then one-on-one is a bit concerning, because there certainly isn't much pace in our central midfield. I think that, for example, when you look at Kyle Beckerman, I think, again, another player who is good at his role, but any time that you have then a very fluid, a very mobile midfield can certainly cause Beckerman some issues. And so you have Jermaine Jones, 34, most likely is going to be his, you know, last big tournament for the U.S. men's national team. So as I look at that midfield, it's probably the you know, the biggest question marks that I have then. And we're going to certainly get the litmus test, I think, right off the bat then with Colombia, which is going to be a good, you know, identification as to how those players are going to hold up. But then my X factor is going to probably be Nagbe coming on. I think he can be a real impact player. Again, in the same way that I have concerns with U.S. In terms of driving midfielders, Nagbe can play that role for U.S. then against its opposition. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how he does, you know, in really the first international tournament that he's really being called upon then for the senior squad.
I'll be really honest. Yeah, I don't rate Kyle Beckerman at all.
I was just going to ask.
I think
tell me why that is, Chris.
I think he's such a one-dimensional midfielder that has lived on this ability to pass backwards and sideways very easily.
I wouldn't disagree.
I find it so baffling that someone like Dax McCarthy plays in that league, contributes on both ends of the ball, might I add, and does exactly the same role plus more, and can't even get near the national team. It genuinely...
Yeah, the Dax... The Dax McCarty thing, it blows my mind, and I will admit I'm partial to the player. I watched him as a youngster here in Florida, but he is a guy that keeps the ball moving and can play the ball forward. I think, once again, you've got a manager that has certain preferences for players based on how they mesh with the group or some other consideration. Kyle Beckerman had very few caps with the national team before Jurgen Klinsmann became the manager. And he was taken down to Copa in that experimental squad in 2007, but was not featured regularly under Bob Bradley except in what we would call B games. Now, Beckerman, for whatever reason, is a player that Klinsmann liked so much. In his very first match as manager, he called him in. He had not been called in for the Gold Cup, which was Bradley's last tournament. Very first match, a month later, after Bob Bradley's sacked against Mexico, Kyle Beckerman is starting in that same holding midfield position, which he continues to occupy. And he's continued to start consistently for the national team. Two friendlies later here in Miami against Honduras, then against Ecuador at Red Bull Arena. Later that, I'm looking at the squad sheets that I have from those games. Kyle Beckerman is a favorite of Jurgen Klinsmann's, if you want to know why he's in this team.
The funny thing is, sorry, Napoon, it's one of the few things I'm genuinely passionate about, in the sense that I've spoken to Dax McCarty about this, and he's never had a proper explanation why he's been in there, and neither has Benny Failharbour either. Mm. And this is, again, the Failharbour issue is another thing that's rattled on, and people have asked him, and he's come back with this answer of he's just behind guys on the depth chart. Personally, I think this is one of Jurgen's real issues, is that he owes those guys an explanation, because the two of them have been really dominating MLS.
Sasha Kleiston also. That's a third guy in the midfield who plays with McCarty at Red Bull, who is an extremely cultured midfielder and is a two-way player, is a box-to-box guy that, by the way, has played well with Michael Bradley in the times they did play together on the national team. Yet he's not. He hasn't gotten, I bet, a proper explanation either, Chris.
No, I remember he got one. He essentially got one go at number 10 in Scotland because I was there, funnily enough, and he was cut from the roster that was going to the tournament. I want to say it was the World Cup roster, possibly, that he was cut from for that for after that game that he didn't make it for. But even still, you look at Sasha Kleiston, most assists in MLS at this point, most game-winning assists, might add as well, more than Sebastian Giovinco. And yet, for some reason, he can't seem to get into this team. And there's a genuine continuity that I appreciate you need sometimes with national teams. But I think with Klinsmann, it's continuity to a fault, because the same guys get opportunities and opportunities.
And it is a desire to prove that he is smarter than the rest of us and smarter than his predecessor. Sasha Kleiston was a player that played for Bob Bradley at Chivas USA and was featured regularly in the national team under Bob Bradley. Benny Failharbour was a guy featured regularly in the national team under Bob Bradley. Guys like Eric Lehigh and Jonathan Bornstein can't scratch, and then Bornstein doesn't deserve it, but he was admitted right away by Klinsmann. Lehigh has been admitted regularly. Jonathan Spector, another player who was a favorite of admittedly of Bob Bradley. So, look, I mean, I don't want to get too far down the road here. Everybody knows where I stand on this, but I think
you love Klinsmann, right?
Yeah, no, I think the manager either has to accomplish something in this tournament or he has to go. And he set these standards, and he hasn't met any of them. We've judged him. People like Chris and I that cover the national team have judged Jurgen Klinsmann by metrics he himself has set. Not by metrics we've arbitrarily set, but by accomplishments he said he would meet and he would accomplish, and he hasn't gotten there.
So, Karthik, let's finish with this. We got to talk about the forwards. And one of the successes of Klinsmann, the few successes, has been Wood and Zardes. And they are complementing a well-experienced forward line with Dempsey and Wondolowski. So talk to me about the forwards. I quite like this forward lineup.
Yeah, I do too, and I just ripped Klinsmann, but let me give you the counter to that, which is Jesse Zardes is a phenomenally good homegrown MLS player who played at Cal State Santa Barbara or Bakersfield. One, I think it was UCSB, who came through the LA Galaxy Academy, I played a little bit of PDL at Ventura County Fusion, a very, very accomplished PDL club. He's a guy who may not have gotten a look from Bob Bradley or Bruce Arena as quickly as he did by Jürgen Klinsmann. And when he had a couple bad outings at the beginning of his national team career, he might have been dropped. So this is to Jürgen Klinsmann's credit. He saw the raw talent. He saw the versatility of Zardes. And Zardes is a guy, we talked about this on the last show, I'm likening to the new Joe Max Moore. You can play him on the wing. You can play him up top as a number nine. You can play him alongside another striker if you're going to play a 4-4-2 or some sort of setup with a second striker. You can play him in the middle almost like, not quite as a number 10, but maybe as a 9.5, a combo a player. And his touch has gotten better. I used to liken him to Breck Shea, who was another of Klinsmann's right. favorites until recently. Breck Shea has zero soccer IQ, as far as I'm concerned, and I watch him week in and week out with Orlando City. A player with fantastic speed, but zero soccer IQ. Jesse Zardes, I likened to Breck Shea 2 years ago at this time. Now I see a guy whose touch has gotten better, whose movement is smarter, who's playing the right passes, playing the right balls. So I really like Zardes, and I give Klinsmann a lot of credit for him. Bobby Wood, similarly, is a player that had been on the radar for a long time, but had not really panned out to our expectations. He's now getting the move to a Bundesliga 1 club in Hamburg. A lot of us who follow the U.S. youth national teams expected that 3 or 4 years ago. But to Klinsmann's credit, he saw the role he could fit in the national team. And having a good summer or a couple friendlies last year with the national team pushed him into a situation where he did very well for Union Berlin this season and now has gotten the move to Hamburg. You mentioned Dempsey. Everybody knows what he provides. He's been a little hot or cold lately, but there's cover for him. And then, of course, you've got Christian Pulisic, a young player who everybody's talking about. I'm a little concerned about the amount of pressure. I see articles even in the British press, your colleagues, Chris, in the UK press talking about this player as the next great global superstar. So a little concerned as an American that not only have we put a lot of pressure on him, and Gabe and I had that conversation in a previous show, right, Gabe, about all the guys that we've anointed as the next great one. Now it's coming from the international media. But he's combining well with Darlington Nagby. And Wando, look, I'm going to defend Klinsmann on this one. There's a lot of controversy about Wando being picked over Jordan Morris. And Jordan Morris is the future. He's part of that bright future we see with guys like Darlington Nagby and Christian Pulisic and a player like Mane at Vancouver, who's going to get U.S. citizenship soon and I believe will be in this national team for 2018. But if we're looking at getting results in this tournament, which again is a bar that Jürgen Klinsmann himself has set, you want a guy who's a reliable goal scorer game in and game out. And knowing that neither Morris or Wondolowski was going to start, I think Wando is the better guy to bring off the bench in the 80th minute to potentially create a scoring opportunity and then get a goal for you. I know people who don't watch MLS and don't know much about this player continue to come back at me with what happened against Belgium. Okay, it happened. Mm. He missed that chance. But I still trust him more than I would trust Jordan Morris right now, and I think Klinsmann made the right choice with Wando. Now, he could live or die with that choice because people are really fired up about it, but in this instance, I'm going to defend Klinsmann on that choice.
Let me add just one brief thought.
Sure.
Just to add on to everything that Kartik said is I think we're going to look at this, though, as well as the whole entire Josie Altidore injury potentially being a blessing in disguise, because as much as Kartik just went on, and I think that we do have a lot of versatility in this striker lineup, if Altidore was healthy, I think there would have been just kind of the gut reaction for Klinsmann to go with Dempsey and Altidore in a lot more cases. And I think this is going to open the door for the likes of Zardes, for Wood to really have more of an impression on this tournament and on this team than they might have otherwise if Josie was healthy.
We will end on what is an exceptionally good point by Gabe. Gabe, you continue to surprise me. We will be back tomorrow. This is the end of the Eurocopa preview pods for Copa Centenario. But tomorrow we'll start the previews for the European Championships. And guess who will be back recording that with me? It'll be none other than Kartik Krishna, Gabe Smith, and Chris Henaj. So on behalf of everyone at World Soccer Talk, this is Nipun Chopra bidding you farewell. Kartik?
Enjoy your football.